Well, I want to welcome you all to this month's OPASI Rounds. As you know, what the OPASI Rounds are trying to do is to really focus in on areas of broad trans-NIH interest. And really, the two of paradigms of this when I arrived here were the obesity initiative we're going to talk about today and the neuroscience blueprint. A couple months ago, we had Story and Tom come tell us about the neuroscience blueprint, and I think it was really effective in broadening those ideas out across the community. So I'm thrilled today to have Betsy Nabel and Griff Rogers come and update the NIH community on what's going on in the obesity initiative. Griff said, what, no introduction? That's about all the introduction I'm going to give. So, Betsy, thank you.
Oh, terrific. Griff and I are delighted to be here this morning on behalf of the Obesity Research Task Force. And first and foremost, I would like everyone who is a member of the task force just to raise your hand. You will see we are a broad, proud, and distinguished group of individuals. And importantly, when it comes time for the questions and answers, those are the folks who are the real experts. So... I wonder if we can get the lights down a little bit. Not enough so everybody falls asleep at 10 in the morning, but maybe a little bit more so you can see. This is what we intend to do today. And by disclosure, we had all members of the task force participate in putting the slide set together. And we are very happy to make this slide set available to the broad community who is interested. Griff and I are going to do a tag team because much of what we do on the task force is a tag team. I'm going to cover the prevalence and a brief description of the task force. Griff will cover basic research, clinical research. I'll then go ahead and do population, education, partnerships, and Griff will finish with the summary. So let's start first by looking at obesity trends across the states. And this is going to go faster than I intended, so we're going to go back at the end. This is the only bit with the animation. I was going to provide a preview here. So I'm going to go back, but and let me describe it. This is all data from the CDC. It's the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, who collects statewide data. And these are obesity trends based on measurements of BMI. In the United States, we consider a BMI less than 25 being normal, 25 to 30 overweight, and over 30 is obese. And a BMI is simply an index of height and weight. So this is data then that has been collected in the United States. We're going to start with 1985, and it cycles every 2 seconds. So you'll see the increment as we go forward. Initially in 85, there was no data in a number of states. Less than 10% of the population is the light blue. The darker blues are 10 to 14 and 15 to 19. And then we go into the yellow and then the orange and the deep sort of red. So let me go back. And the big point is over the past 20 years, there have been phenomenal increases in the obesity rates throughout the United States. So this is the 85 data. And as you can see, much of the central portion of the country and western portion of the country was right on target. And now it's going to start to cycle. So you'll see how this changes over the ensuing 20 years. What you'll focus on is this part of the country in particular. This is what we call the stroke belt. This part of the country, the southeast, has phenomenal rates of heart disease and stroke. We've never, ever been able to get a good handle on it. But this is the part of the U.S. as well that is obese. Let me show you data in other areas. That was all for adults. This is now data for children. And we don't measure BMIs as much in kids, but we do look at overweight. And overweight is if you are exceed the 95th percentile for height and weight. So these are boys and girls, 6 to 11 years old, boys and girls, 12 to 19. And this starts in 1971 and goes up to 2002. And you can see that in both genders, all age groups, there's an increase in obesity in this country. Current rates up around 18%. I think it's probably even higher. This is 2002 data, so we're probably, what, at 18% or so in the states right now. And then this is by race and ethnicity. Again, going back to 99 and ending in 2004, So the yellow is non-Hispanic white, the gold is non-Hispanic black, and the red is Mexican-American. We've always observed that Hispanic communities here in the United States are at increased risk for obesity. There's been obviously a catch-up with African-Americans as well as Caucasians. So this is a trend that applies to all race and ethnic groups in the country. Now, obesity, as you can imagine, has profound effects for all aspects of medicine. Typically, the major complications, as you can imagine, manifest themselves initially as diabetes, but also as the major risk factors for heart disease, hypertension, dyslipidemia, ending in coronary heart disease. And as you know, coronary heart disease is the mode of death for many people with diabetes and obesity. There are a number of papers that have come out recently showing that as our children become more obese, we are seeing the appearance of risk factors for heart disease at much earlier ages that we never saw in the past. And maybe during the question-answer session, we can talk a little bit more about risks for cancer and some of the other disorders. But clearly, this is something that affects all of the institutes. And we are paying for it. And we're going to continue to pay for it in a major league way. This is data now for annual Medicare. So Medicare hitting the younger populations at the lower SES. Charges during 84 to 2002 for inpatient outpatient care by baseline BMI in men at baseline age of 46. So what you can see is that cardiovascular disease costs and total costs for health care, Medicare costs men age 46 at baseline, increase as a function of BMI. So those comorbidities that I just showed you manifest themselves very clearly in terms of health care costs. Now, what's the NIH doing about this? Well, in 2003, Dr. Zerhouni charged that we needed a trans-NIH obesity research task force. He asked the directors of NIDDK and NHLBI to co-chair. At the time, it was Alan Spiegel and Claude L'Enfant. Griff and I are grateful to have inherited the task force and now co-lead it. But this slide really summarizes the 25 institute centers and offices that have participated in the task force since its inception in 03. So you can see that this is truly a trans NIH effort. Alan and Claude and Barbara Elving were instrumental in putting together a strategic plan for the task force. This was released, I believe, in 04. And as you can see, the task force really envisioned that the plan would encompass a wide range of activities related to obesity, beginning with basic science, going through clinical investigations, population studies, economic research, and education and outreach programs. And in fact, our funding for obesity continues to rise on an annual basis. I believe our funding in 05 was about $490 million or so. In 06, it's $590 million. So you can see that across the institutes, we do have a major commitment. How does the task force work? Well, we meet on a quarterly basis. We invite all institutes, centers, and offices to send representatives. We have opened up the meeting so that if you want to have more than one representative, we're delighted to have you. We initially organized the task force into a series of subgroups, and it's really the subgroups here that really do much of the work. We focus on scientific gaps, areas in which initiatives could go forward. There are typically workshops then to address those gaps. And then often initiatives will come forward that are really shared broadly across the task force so that multiple institutes have an opportunity to plan and shape those efforts as they go forward. And I've just given you an example here of some of the past solicitations that have gone out. And as you can see, they are very broad in their reach. We also are delighted to have a number of very senior scientific leaders who chair these task force, but also who provide senior leadership to the task force. And I just want to now acknowledge Dr. Van Hubbard, who is here. And Van has been our liaison with the department. And as you know, the department, well, Van, come on. I want folks to recognize what you do. Yeah. You know, the department has, the secretary has a major initiative in prevention. The acting Surgeon General, Steve Galson, has taken this on, as well as Penny Rowell. And Van has been our major lead with respect to coordination with the department and other federal agencies. We also have a senior scientific leadership group within the task force, and I want to just acknowledge Terry Wong from NICHD, Sue Yankowski and Phil Smith from NIDDK, Rachel Ballard-Ballish from NCI, Denise Simons-Morton from NHLBI, and I think that's our group who have really taken leadership here. So that is our by way of introduction, serious problem in the United States and worldwide. We do have a very active group here on the NIH campus to begin to address the issue, and Griff will now take over and articulate some of these advances. Okay.
Well, thanks, Betsy. I think this works. Let me also welcome the group here, and it really is a pleasure to have the opportunity to share some of this information with you. What I'm going to do in a short time, a lot, it really is to sort of go over some of the basic research and clinical research that has been inspired and coordinated by not only the individual institutes, but also by the Obesity Research Task Force. And clearly, these clinical and basic research topics have really illuminated broader principles which have improved our current understanding of the pathophysiology of obesity and its related comorbidities, but also it has actually shined a light on potential targets, therapeutic targets, in our fight against obesity. But before I go into that, from a sort of a practical standpoint, this change in incidence and prevalence of obesity that we're seeing in this country really has very profound effects and is projected to have even more profound effects in the way that we do business. You've probably seen in the newspapers where, for example, when you go on flights, there are certain airlines that are charging more for people who normally would sit in one seat, now are occupying more than one seat. The way that certainly hospitals are facing the brunt of this, not only because of those comorbidities that Dr. Nabel showed you and having to deal with that, but clearly they have to accommodate different size devices to take care of these patients. We're having to change things in the workforce, even at home. Really, there's not even venerable and sort of cherished establishments that have not been left out of this equation. Let me see another show of hands. How many people have taken their kids or nieces and nephews to Disneyland or Disney World and been on this small world? Well, it turns out that it's not a small world after all. This is a recent report actually in the Associated Press. It hasn't gotten a lot of press, but Disney World rides to get supersized and retrofitted. Disneyland plans to close. This was just in November in the Associated Press. The 41-year-old Flume ride in January of 2008 to give it a much-needed uplift to deal with the delicate problem of this thing bottoming out. For those of you who remember from basic biophysics, this ride goes over a small density of water, and what's been happening is that water has been displaced, and the rides appear to get stuck near the Canadian Mounties and the Scandinavian geese exhibit. And it's not only the adults, which they point out in this paper, that the average size has increased by 25 pounds since the ride was introduced in 1960. There's been a 65% increase, as Dr. Nabel has just indicated, in those considered overweight or obese. But obviously, even the children are contributing to this problem. And so, again, there's really nothing that's sacred anymore. But it really begs the question in terms of this. It's sort of a good introduction. Where, at what stage do we really need to start considering whether obesity is a problem that occurs later in life? Is it imprinted somehow in early adolescence or childhood? And let me sort of begin by sharing some of the basic and clinical research that are giving us better handles on that. What this study points out here a strong suggestion that the intrauterine exposure or environment may play a critical role, in a sense, in imprinting the susceptibility to obesity later on in life. And this was a study that was conducted in our intramural program among Pima Indians who reside on the Gila River Reservation out near Phoenix. What the investigators have been looking at very carefully are really sib pairs in which one sibling is born and they've been following their weight, and then in a mother who has not yet had diabetes, and comparing the weight of a child who's born to that same mother after the mother has in fact developed diabetes. And so most of the factors are sort of controlled for, and the only variable there is whether or not the child may have been exposed to a diabetic environment in utero. You can see that starting at the 9 through 12, 12 through 15, there's a much greater weight among the kids who were born in this environment after the mother has developed diabetes. And in most instances, these kids are actually younger than their sibling counterparts. So this really strongly indicates that the something about the intrauterine environment might be extremely important in sort of imprinting this signal. We don't know what the mechanism of that is, but there are a number of studies that are ongoing to really define the underlying mechanism of this programming or metabolic disease in utero. Here's a study that was funded in the Oregon Primate Center, in which these non-human primates, a rhesus macaque, or either maternally or fed a high diet or a controlled diet with 15% fat for a period of 4 years, and they were compared to mothers who were fed a high-fat diet, 35% over the same year. If you biopsy the liver of the offspring, you can see that in the control animals, there's very little in the way of fat reflected by this brownish staining for fat cells in the liver. But look, the large amount of steatosis, liver steatosis, in the high-fat treated group. Not only do you see changes in these offspring in their livers, but if you look in their brains, in certain areas of the hypothalamus, you can see an upregulation of the melanocortins in the region of the hypothalamus, indicated here on this imaging study. And this melanocortins is really critical in regulating food intake in these animals. Now, an interesting aspect of this study is that although this was started out to look at really the effects on the infants, it turns out that only half of these animals that are given this high-fat diet actually end up becoming overweight themselves. But independent of what happens to the mother, all of the offspring show this type of phenotype. So clearly there's important aspects of the intrauterine environment that we have to sort of consider. Plans to continue this work in this area really have been generated by the task force, and the underlying mechanism of this fetal program is an area of intense investigation. In order to sort of understand how other genetic regulators might play into this, this is an interesting study in which there are two forms of rats, or rats, litter mates. And it turns out in one of these rats there is this so-called agouti rat that shows a variable degree of methylation at certain sites. Now, this agouti mouse, generally hypermethylation at this agouti site is associated with a silencing of that gene, and the mouse having a brownish coat, and the phenotype is shown here. The litter mates, however, that demonstrate hypomethylation of this gene are associated with overexpression in a ubiquitous fashion in these mice. And in fact, we now know that the that this agouti is actually an antagonist of the melanocortin receptor. And in these susceptible mice, this, because of the key role of melanocortin, this changes the skin coat of these mice from brown to this kind of yellowish color. However, upregulation and an aberrant expression at the level of the hypothalamus actually also gives rise to this obesity and diabetes phenotype. In fact, it was this mouse that really provided us an explanation or a better understanding of the critical role of melanocortin receptors in the process of obesity as it relates to the regulation of food intake. Interestingly, if you give maternal agouti mice a diet high in folate, which can be a methyl donor, and you drive the this gene to be hypermethylated again, the offspring do not exhibit this phenotype and will all have the brownish skin coat and be of normal size. Well, we're very excited about the prospects of learning more about these epigenetic phenomena. In fact, there's a roadmap initiative, I think, led by Dr. Volkow in the audience, which I think will go further into this topic, and I'm sure that we'll learn a whole lot more, not only about the obesity phenotype, but another of other examples of where epigenetic events will play an important role early on in development. Now, infancy and early childhood may obviously be critical periods for inappropriate weight gain, and there's clearly several longitudinal studies that have been identified where risk factors may be represented early in life. Here are three examples of such studies looking at infancy and early childhood. This study by Stunkert from the University of Pennsylvania examined lean and obese mothers and very quickly came to the conclusion that energy intake and a sucking behavior, enhanced sucking behavior during a meal, even as early as 3 months, predicted quite nicely an increase in body size among those infants at 2 years. And it turns out that this effect was independent of the size of the mother. There have been additional studies which show that early childhood temperament or throwing tantrums during eating behavior or even decrease in sleep appears to be a good marker and a good predictor of subsequent overweight. And then a more recent study in 2003 showed that rapid weight gain during early infancy may be associated with an increased likelihood of obesity at the age of 20. And so there's clearly very early markers that sort of predict the ultimate outcome. And there are other studies looking at these types of phenomena as well. Well, although we're focusing on this early infancy and childhood are certainly important in terms of its predictive characteristics, clearly what we need are studies to examine in people who have established obesity, are there behavioral interventions that might play an important role in diminishing the obesity phenotype and thereby diminishing the comorbidities associated with it. So what I'm going to show you now are examples of three studies in adults and one in children, which have really tried to address that question. This is a study called the Diabetes Prevention Program, or the DPP, which was that we led, but which was co-funded by a number of other NIH institutes. The study involved over 3,000 individuals at high risk for diabetes. They had so-called pre-diabetes on the basis of glucose tolerance tests. It was a three-arm trial comparing placebo, metformin, an established drug for the use of people with established diabetes, as well as a lifestyle modification which consisted of intensive exercise, diets, dietary modification, and a decrease in the amount of calories. And what can be what isn't shown here is that these interventions, especially the lifestyle intervention, was only associated with about a 5 or 7% reduction in overall body weight, but this reduction was associated with about a 60% reduction in the risk of going on to subsequent diabetes development. And in fact, this effect, which is about 60%, was about twice as great as the effect seen by the drug metformin alone. Very similar observations were done in a trial led by the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. In this trial, individuals who had pre-hypertension, or I guess it was at that time termed high borderline normal blood pressure, underwent an intervention to attempt to decrease the amount of weight in these susceptible individuals. And you can see that this intervention was quite effective. At 6 months, there was about a 4.5 kilogram weight loss, 10 pounds. That 10 pounds over time, as you follow these patients, the same is true in the diabetes prevention program, over time, there is first a great weight, great weight loss, and then a subsequent recovery, so that you can see at 3 years the weight came back on, but because the control group continued to show an increase in their weight, there was still about a 2 kilogram difference in weight at the 3 years after this observation. At 6 months, the intervention group showed a reduction in their blood pressure, and this was associated with a reduction, overall risk reduction of about 42%. And even at 3 years, there was still a decrease in the blood pressure levels in these individuals in the intervention group, and that was associated with about a 19% overall risk reduction. So I think the point here is that even a modest weight loss has both immediate and apparent sustained effects in these individuals. Here's another study conducted by the Heart Institute, looking at the effects of lifestyle intervention on weight and hypertension prevalence, the so-called PREMIER study. These, again, was a three-arm study comparing advice, simple advice, to an established intervention which resulted in weight loss, targeted at weight loss, increasing physical activity, and a decrease in the amount of sodium in the diet. And in addition, there was the established plus DASH. The DASH intervention consisted of 9 to 12 fruits and vegetables, a higher serving of low-fat dairy products. And you can see that, again, both of these interventions led to about a 4 kilogram weight loss at 6 months, and that was sustained at 18 months. And that this was associated with a reduction in both the percentage of individuals who went on to subsequently develop hypertension, both at 6 months and at 18 months, with these two types of interventions. Again, modest weight loss, small steps, sort of big rewards from the standpoint of the observation. Now, here's a trial actually in children, the so-called GEMS trial. And I always have to look up to see what these acronyms mean. GEMS stands for the Girls Enrichment Multi-Site Studies, or GEMS, which is really a program involving two interventions, trial testing the approach to reduce excessive weight gain in low-income African-American girls aged 8 to 10 years. This involved extensive behavioral interventions, both with the child, often with the mother. One can see here that in this intervention group, the number of kids that the utilization of sweetened beverages diminished somewhat in the intervention group, and there was a corresponding increase in the water intake reported in this group compared to the controls, and the number of servings of vegetables were also increased in this group. and despite what appears, and though these are statistically significant, appear to be only modest effects, you can see that in comparison to the control group, the rate at which these young girls gain weight at 12 and subsequently at 24 months was greatly abrogated. And so these types of interventions, I think, are extremely important. Studies really at the community level and at the individual level, in which one is sort of intervening with targeted populations at greatest risk. Let me just sort of summarize what I've said so far, is that moderate amount of weight loss results in really clinically meaningful effect with respect to cardiovascular risk factors, just a 2 to 6 kilogram weight loss, or about 5 or 10% of body weight, associated with about a 20 to 53% reduction in hypertension incidence or prevalence. I didn't show you, but about a 47% reduction in LDL cholesterol, and in the DPP study, a 58% reduction in diabetes mellitus incidence. And these effects obviously will reduce the subsequent need of medication. However, I think there are really still important questions that need to be answered, and these are being answered by current ongoing studies that the Obesity Research Task Force are really actively sort of involved in. One is, for example, does intentional weight loss reduce cardiovascular events? So certainly the subsequent development of risk factors, there have been an intervention, but if one looks at hard endpoints like MIs, stroke, or death, this is important to determine. So the Look Ahead trial is a trial that is looking into this issue, whether in people who have established diabetes, weight loss in a sustained basis can diminish their cardiovascular events. There are several trials that the Heart Institute is focusing on, both in weight loss maintenance using internet-assisted effective tools, as well as this POWER trial, which is really looking at the practice-based approaches. Many of these trials are obviously done by large consortiums, but at a practitioner-based level, it's important to determine what effective tools can be translated out in the community. And then finally, we're bombarded with different types of diet: high protein, low carbohydrate, the Atkinson's, the Miami, etc. This POUND study is really looking at what macronutrient compositions is really best for weight loss composition. In this particular trial there, it's the variables are the percentage of carbohydrates, the percentages of fats, and the percentages of proteins to really try to optimize that. And this is, again, an ongoing study that I think we'll be hearing more about. Clearly, there's in people who are overweight or obese, as defined earlier with BMIs up to BMIs of 30, these types of effective interventions might be quite important. But what about people who are morbidly obese, people who have BMIs greater than 40? Clearly, bariatric surgery is an area that has been utilized in them. And while gastric bypass surgery is really becoming the gold standard, there are several other techniques, banding and vertical banding gastroplasty, that seems to be effective, in fact, quite effective, in terms of very rapid weight loss. And these, by rapid, I mean within the first 1 or 2 years after the surgical intervention. But clearly, gastric bypass leads to the most profound loss in weight and the sustained weight that can be seen in this. There are actually back-to-back papers in the New England Journal of Medicine just a few months ago that really addressed this issue. Bariatric surgery appears to actually have effects on comorbidities such as diabetes even before one sees this very profound effect. In fact, even within a few weeks of the surgery, one can see a normalization in people who have all the parameters indicating that they have diabetes if a glucose tolerance is repeated. So obviously that effect is independent of any effect on the actual weight loss and insulin resistance that might result from that. It is thought that by changing the anatomy and the physiology that there may be incretins or other substances that may have effects, and we're only beginning to learn more about that. In fact, the ORTF has put out a PA to really begin to examine this type of issue specifically. Now, in that same issue of the New England Journal, there was a study that we funded from the University of Utah and Adams Group, which actually showed that with gastric surgery, in fact, all-cause death was reduced compared to controls who were of the same weight but who were still either in weight loss programs or having counseling, a reduction of about 35% in all-cause death with about a 7 to 10-year follow-up, about a 60% reduction in cardiovascular death, surprisingly, a similar level of reduction in cancer-related death, a whopping 90% reduction in diabetes-related death in these individuals who had undergone gastric bypass surgery. In fact, there are certain centers now who are actually advertising gastric bypass as a treatment and a cure for diabetes, but I think we have to be very cautious about this. It's important to note, however, that despite these all-cause related deaths, that there was an increase in non-disease related deaths within these individuals who underwent gastric bypass, including an increase in accidents and suicides. We now have a number of psychiatrists working on this issue because you may be somehow selecting out a group of patients who, even though they do manifest an improvement in their size, may have some psychological aspects of the benefits that they have generated still are not up to their expectations, leading them to be involved in risky behaviors in a sense. And this is important, I think, to further characterize and to understand. This is a very complicated slide, and I won't even begin to walk you through it, but I think that in the last 10 years since the discovery, or 10 or more years since the discovery of leptin in 1994 and the critical role that leptin plays in food intake and energy expenditure and energy intake, we really have learned quite a bit of the neurobiology related to smell and sight and taste and the role of hormones and other fuels in energy expenditure, energy assimilation, and whether we ingest or reject certain substances that we come in contact with. Really, I think moving forward, this is really the largest area of scientific exploration, because I think in this particular area, this will bring basic scientists together with neurobiologists to begin to tackle these important questions. But as you can see from this diagram, you have a number of endpoints in which there may be therapeutic interventions. Let me just move a little quickly here. Many of the comorbidities that were sort of outlined, clearly there has to be some sort of unifying principle behind this, and I think we've greatly learned now that inflammation plays a critical role, and you can see here these macrophages inside fat cells, which might elaborate cytokines that contribute to the dysfunction of a number of organs. We're now seeing the same types of macrophages in obese women and in their placenta, and in fact, this may be of critical importance with respect to this imprinting in terms of their children subsequently to an increased susceptibility to obesity and diabetes. Now, one aspect of the task force was to try to break the link between obesity and the associated comorbidities. And this slide is necessarily unintelligible. You can't actually read the words, but we've really greatly benefited from a number of animal models that have kind of begun to give us important areas of potential intervention. This is a genetically engineered mice shown here on the left, the so-called OBOB mouse. And what has been done in this experiment is that there has been an overexpression of a gene that's critically important for the fat stores, adiponectin. So within the context of an OBOB mice, if you overexpress this adiponectin gene, actually you have a greater reservoir for fat to accumulate. So if you now treat these animals and give them a high-fat diet, they do accumulate fat in these subcutaneous stores. But interestingly, the overexpression leads to the prevention of accumulation of fat in other tissues. And as a result, there is a normalization of glucose, an improvement in insulin sensitivity, and a reduction of serum triglycerides, and a decrease in the hepatic steatosis. Now, I'm not saying that this is a way to treat obesity, this is a sort of shift where the fat is deposited, but clearly now we can begin to break this link by studies such as this type. Let me just conclude to say that in this particular case, this may be good news to mice everywhere, but obviously humans and mice are not the same. And ultimately, studying humans, we will gain the most information by directly studying humans. And I think future areas of our task force emphasis will begin to image both centrally the effects of behavior and neurobiology on energy expenditure and intake, as well as peripherally. We obviously want to learn more about the tantalizing information we're getting on intrauterine and neonatal environment, on the development of metabolic diseases, the neurobiology of human behavior, and again, more sensitive tools for measuring energy intake and expenditure, and then finally, this role of inflammation and obesity. And with that, let me turn it back to my colleague who will discuss population and behavioral research as well as other features.
Well, thank you very much, Griff, for the... As you can see, the field is moving very quickly. And I now will sort of focus on population behavioral research and then end with our education outreach activities and our partnerships. So one of the aspects that we recognize is that we really need to bring together and link basic research, clinical research, and population-based research. And the TREC initiative from the NCI is a wonderful example of this. The TREC initiative is a 5-year effort aimed at reducing cancer linked with obesity, poor diet, and low levels of physical activity. And it has a number of goals, but you can see how it is bringing in resources and approaches from the full spectrum of basic work through clinical work and evaluation metrics. And I think that, as you have seen, one of the themes that we'll take away from today is that really addressing the obesity issue, one has to have broad approaches to really connect and link together many of the efforts in the specific fields. In addition, there have been a number of observational epidemiological studies of various populations that have provided a wealth of information about obesity, such as associations of obesity with subsequent disease, as well as prior factors associated with prevalence or development obesity. And this slide summarizes some of the types of information that many of the epidemiological studies within the NHLBI, which are cited here, have explored or are exploring with respect to obesity. So one of the goals then has been to really utilize many of the long-standing observational cohorts that many of us have funded over the years and really now mine those very rich data sets for information related to diabetes. And I think the fact that many of us are now investing in genotyping of these cohorts. For example, we've just released the genotype and phenotype information from Framingham in DBGAP, now allows investigators to really explore questions, genetic questions related to obesity. Let me provide you some examples of some of the things that we have learned from these observational epidemiological studies. We've done, investigators have done a sub-analysis in the Framingham Heart Study looking at individuals who are either have a normal BMI or would be considered overweight or obese, looking at men and at women. And you can see that the cumulative incidence of heart failure in both genders increases with overweight and obese status. Very important finding, as heart failure now represents one of the largest, if not the largest, DRG or cause for hospital admission in this country. And in addition, we have learned from our cardia study of young adults in this country that if, as a young person, you continue to consume more fast food over a 15-year period, you will indeed gain more weight. These are the baseline fast food intakes, numbers of fast food meals times per week, and then this is the change over a 15-year period and weight gain. So if you consume less than one fast food meal per week at baseline and you continue that over a 15-year period, you are more than likely to gain a smaller amount of weight compared to an individual who consumed more at baseline and continued to consume more over a 15-year period of time. Again, all leading to the concept that diet plays an important role in weight gain over adulthood. We gather data from multiple sources. Some of the data that we have accumulated on weight gain and obesity comes from self-reports. We have two national self-report survey data resources, the state-level behavioral risk factor surveillance system, which I showed you on the maps earlier, as well as the NHANES data, which both of which are conducted out of the CDC. It's very interesting. With advances in the technology, we can now provide individuals with accelerometers or other forms of technology which can actually measure energy utilization. And NIH supported the addition of these accelerometers to the NHANES data sets in 03 and 04. And in this report of 4,500 individuals, adults, from NHANES, the accelerometer data indicated that only 3 to 4% of adults were meeting their physical activity recommendations, as opposed to the self-reports, where adults thought somewhere between 40 and 50% of adults felt that they were meeting the physical activity recommendations. So our perceptions of physical activity actually exceed our actual measures of physical activity. Again, I think a very interesting observation. Now, we do know that environment plays an extraordinarily important role on physical activity and obesity. There has been a lot of evidence that has emerged over the concept of the built environment. And I think on behalf of the task force, we're very pleased to say that many of these concepts will be further explored in the GEI initiatives. And indeed, there is one particular initiative on diet and physical activity that's being led by the NCI that NHLBI is participating in that we think will be very important. But I think that this is an area that we're going to have to look at with increasing vigor in the future as we build environments for our children that discourage physical activity. I think one of the most important and interesting papers that has come out recently was this study of social networks and the effects of social networks on obesity that was reported in the New England Journal that looked at Framingham Heart Study individuals. These investigators looked at about 12,000 participants in the Framingham Heart Study that were assessed from 1971 to 2003. And these investigators used longitudinal statistical modeling to examine whether weight gain in one person was associated with weight gain in that individual's friends, siblings, spouse, or neighbors. And what the slide shows on the left are the probability that the identified Framingham participant will become obese as related to the various types of people in his or her social network becoming obese. So, for example, the likelihood of becoming obese increased by about 60% if someone, a Framingham subject, considered their friend became obese. So this is someone that you perceived to be your friend. However, the likelihood increased 170% if you identify that individual as your friend and that person identified you as their friend. Mutual friendships, 170% increase in the likelihood of obesity. Now, what I find very interesting is look at the effect of spouse. Mutual friend has a much greater impact than spouse, and I'll let you read in your own interpretations. But nonetheless, the study found that clusters of obese individuals in a connected social network really is the overriding factor that can really influence whether one does become obese over the course of adulthood. So we have a lot of data on hand that has given us a number of very interesting results. Throughout the task force, we've done a number of national and regional health surveys to evaluate diet, physical activity, and weight. We have initiated provider surveys of health behavior practices, but there are a number of efforts going on in the future where we will look much more closely at measures focused on individuals, to connecting those to measures of community systems and environments. And we also want to look at NIH-supported healthcare delivery research infrastructures to examine long-term outcomes of obesity management in community practice. So as you can see, we are really moving towards an environment community-based approach here. There are a number of interventional studies that are going on, along with the observational epidemiological studies. We know that directed interventions are also important in the community for primary prevention, and this shows you some of those examples, but you can see work at the worksite, again, getting out into the community. So let me just move on now and begin to summarize with some of our education outreach activities and our partnerships. I think it's absolutely fundamental to understand that all that we do within the task force is evidence-based. It's built upon the science that we generate through our research support. We use that science base then to tailor our education and communication strategies that then allows us to engage in partnerships both at the local and the national levels. Across the NIH, we have a number of focused educational initiatives. These are two-pronged. One focuses on targeting, reaching individuals at very high risk for adverse health effects related with being overweight and obese, and the other is a population-based strategy, working with communities, schools, work sites on to try to prevent overweight and obesity by a focus on diet and physical activity. I'm pleased to say that the NIH has been at these educational efforts for a long time. One of the first steps in harnessing our knowledge and understanding of the research related to overweight and obesity in adults was the development of clinical guidelines for the identification, evaluation, and treatment of overweight and obesity in adults. This evidence-based report was released by the NIH in June of 1998, and these clinical guidelines really became the foundation for a number of strategies across the government. They've been endorsed by multiple agencies in the federal government and Over the past 10 years, over 60 federal agencies as well as professional societies have endorsed and have utilized these. We know that these now need to be updated and we have to move on, but I think the NIH has clearly established a stake in the ground as being a landmark. This has been a landmark study which has been fundamental for all other activities that we've done. Once these guidelines were completed, we then went on to develop a series of tailored educational products for professionals and patients. These just summarize some of the educational materials, and you can see that they go from print to web-based to a Palm application system, and they can be accessed at the website here, healthyweightnhlbinih.com. We're returning now to the clinical guidelines on obesity in the form of integrated guidelines. This is a new effort for us at the NHLBI. We historically have had silo guidelines in hypertension, cholesterol, and other areas, but we now are integrating those guidelines based on cardiovascular risk and their association with other comorbidities. This will be a web-based program in which we will continually evaluate evidence as it becomes available. We will utilize panels of experts throughout the country and continually update those guidelines so they're current and, again, evidence-based. The other major activity which has really taken on by storm around the country is the We Can program, which was launched in 2005. And has been supported by primarily by four institutes here at the NIH, but others are joining. Karen Donato has been the lead. This is a community-based program for parents and healthcare providers to provide educational materials for children. We Can stands for Ways to Enhance Children's Activity and Nutrition. Since 2005, we have had over 500 community sites in 44 states join us. There are a variety of settings, from schools to parks to rec departments. We're very excited because there are eight cities that are now We Can cities that coordinate We Can programs throughout the school systems and the rec departments. In November, we welcomed Boston, Pittsburgh, and Las Vegas to the We Can city as new We Can sites. And we had the pleasure of doing a program at the Children's Museum in Boston, in which Mayor Tom Marino joined us, as well as representatives of the public school system and the rec department in Boston, who are very, very excited about initiating this program. And very, very interesting, we've had a number of Fortune 500 companies join us as well to implement the We Can program at the worksite. So again, we're really trying to branch out and target important components of the worksite and the community. This is just an example of some of the materials that are available and can be accessed through our We Can website. It's really caught on with amazing speed. Partnerships are an important component of what we do. We recognize here at the NIH that we generate much of the research knowledge that then can be used by other groups and agencies to really implement effective programs. One of the partnerships that we're very pleased and proud of is our partnership with the CDC and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. As many of you know, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has recently announced that they plan to spend or allocate over $500 million towards childhood obesity in this country. And so we now, with RWJF and the CDC, are beginning to engage in a series of conversations about how we can partner together. We have a very important strategic planning meeting in February of 2008, in which we will discuss strategic priorities for each organization, define areas of commonalities and gaps, and identify the most relevant areas of childhood obesity prevention and control that we can focus on and work and coordinate together. So we're very excited and pleased about that program. And finally, we'll ask Griff to summarize.
Thanks, Betsy. So just to kind of take us back to where we started, this Obesity Research Task Force founded in 2003 with the strategic plan that has been identified. And if we were to give ourselves a scorecard, first of all, I would say that the obesity effort has really been catalyzed by this plan, and it truly is a trans-NIH effort. There are over 25 institutes and centers and offices that have been very actively participating in this effort. I think we've made considerable progress in research toward preventing and treatment of obesity, at least on four fronts. One is, as I try to illustrate, studies related to behavioral and environmental approaches to lifestyle modifications, and within those you can see that small changes have big and profound effects. The question is whether those effects are going to be sustainable and how we can translate basically research questions and get those out in the community, out into the work sites. I think we've also been able to identify targets and pathways for pharmacologic, surgical, or other medical approaches to the treatment of and prevention of diabetes, and we have a deeper understanding now, I think, between the relationship of obesity and associated medical conditions. And although we didn't have the opportunity to discuss this in this venue, I think the Obesity Research Task Force has really catalyzed the development of really cross-cutting areas, the development of new technologies, and I think the intersection with the gene and environment studies will really highlight and push this forward. Also, research teams, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary teams to sort of approach this problem. And also translational research, and by that I mean sort of translation one from the traditional bench to bedside, and also translation two from the bedside ultimately into the community. So I guess if we were to give ourselves a scorecard, I think we've done quite a bit in the short period of time that this strategic plan has been in operation, but obviously we can't be content. We have to continue to evaluate ourselves and continue to have others evaluate our efforts as well. I think moving forward, there are going to be obvious areas of future emphasis, some of which you've already heard about. Clearly, the neurobiology and bringing together basic scientists with behavioral people, either an interdisciplinary or a multiple disciplinary way, I think will provide us with a lot of fruit for potential informative exploration. The role of the intrauterine and the neonatal environment, again, I think it's other areas, the gene environment studies, population-based studies, I think imaging and coming up with non-invasive techniques to begin to characterize behavioral events. This is something that people have been stressing, but I think we can now sort of get a handle on this with the increase in precision and resolution of newer imaging modalities. And obviously the role of inflammation, as this really appears to provide a centralized hypothesis linking inflammation, obesity, and its associated effects. As Betsy just indicated, I think this is important for us to sort of transform data into knowledge, but it's more important to somehow put knowledge into action. And I think transforming knowledge into action is really the important role of enhancing our education and outreach efforts, some of which you've heard. And I think for the foreseeable future, we will obviously be in our budget outlook environment is not great, and even if this wasn't the case, I think it's important that we forge partnerships. There are areas that NIH does well and does extremely well, and there are other areas that historically it hasn't really been in our province. So I think forging these productive partnerships with with other agencies like the CDC, with nonprofits, and with groups like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Kaiser Family Foundation, Kellogg, and others, I think will really be the way to go. We started a little bit late. I think we've really given you a lot to digest, no pun intended, and I think the PIP members of the group that are here would really be available to answer any questions that you might have. Thanks.
Well, I really want to thank you guys for seamless tag team there. I was very impressed. Let me start off. I have a question, and I don't know how much I'm projecting versus the reality of this, and it has to do with the impact the task force has had on collaboration, on true transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, all those different things, because I seem to see a transition. There were the 25 institute centers and offices, and they each have their own portfolio. But how is the task force, and you could see it sort of palpably over time here, develop this trans and this developed coordination, and particularly for obesity, where you really need these different expertise. It is coming together as a new interdiscipline. So I wonder if both of you may want to comment about how that's happened over your tenures.
I would prefer that perhaps Terry or Rachel, Abby, some of the others, why don't you speak to this? Because you know, I think one of the key, Ellen, is that Griff and I step out of the way and encourage folks to work together. But Terry, Rachel, you want to speak to this?
You know, I think one of the reasons that this actually has catalyzed a lot of work
in this area is that there was a very ready group of people in all of the institutes who are committed to seeing this whole field move. And that's largely functioned through a number of these working groups. There wasn't time to really talk about that in any detail, but those groups tend to be quite large. We're getting a lot of input from different people about how to move forward in those areas. So it's been my perspective, and I've been now at NIH for, you know, at least over 15 years, more than that. This is one of the most rapidly trans-NIH activities that I've seen taken on, where we really do seem to be able to talk across areas of interest and discipline. And one of the ways we've tried to move this is to work at having those institutes in the lead who have some past experience in a particular area, and they help sort of begin the conceptual framework for it, and then we really bring in others. So I'm sure others have some of the
social evolution, though? Do you feel that at first people are more tentative working together, and now they're building new organizational interactions or not?
To some extent, though I will say that one also has to be aware that the nutrition and physical activity communities are very small, and we know each other quite well. So, you know, I've known most of these people for about 20 years. And we go to a lot of the same meetings. So what this has allowed is us to not have to respond to the traditional institute silo barriers and just say, how are we going to get the work done? And so there may be others who can articulate that more.
I would agree that I think it's been really a cross-institute effort, and that push, you know, continues as we move towards a more systems approach to obesity. I think some of the difficulties in, you know, really further strengthening the cross-institute collaboration is, you know, really kind of boils down to dollar amounts and you know, having different institutes to pool their resources together. The task force itself doesn't really have a budget, so, you know, individual institutes still have to, you know, commit resources towards any, you know, trans-NIH ideas. I think the spirit and the collaboration are extremely strong. But you know, we need to continue to work on generating pooled resources.
So, do you have a handle on the almost 20% increase in the last year in spending on obesity? Do you think that was more in this trans or interdisciplinary area? Does anyone have a feel for that?
I don't know the exact amount, but I think a significant portion of it is. I mean, almost any PA or RFA that goes out now is co-sponsored by multiple institutes. I can't think of any that isn't. And so, there's a tremendous synergy.
This is Charlotte. I serve on the Environment and Behavior Subcommittee of the Task Force, and one of the things that we have been doing is looking at the strategic plan that deal with environment and behavior, and then looking at all the themes and the goals that were recommended, and looking at whether we have funded, looking at our portfolio, so to see whether we have funded studies in those areas. And we've been doing this collaboratively with all the institutes involved, and I think that we have a fairly large number of institute representatives, almost about three-quarters of the NIH institutes. So in doing that, we've been able to really come up with areas that are gap that we need to work on, and areas that we can develop new initiatives. And we've had, during our meetings, people coming to present their initiative proposals and having collaboration in it. So I think it's at its infancy, but it's moving forward.
We have a set of initiatives that have been supported in bioengineering approaches for measuring obesity states and energy balance. And this was a sequence of program announcements and RFAs, and one of which brought in fact the support of the National Science Foundation, because we felt that they had access to a community of researchers who would not normally pay much attention to the NIH guide. And this worked very effectively. I think even though obviously at home any of us can set up initiatives and we can put them through the normal process, and we can use the ENS system as a chat room for finding out who else might be interested, having the task force accelerates the process of knowing who to contact, who has interest, and it highlights the priority within each institute, especially with the knowledge and, you know, of two institute directors, which goes way beyond the usual program level activity. So it really makes a difference to have these things tied into the task force staff contacts, support, and the priorities, which are very clear, laid out through the strategic plan. So it works very well.
Yes. Some of us were here in 2003 in February when this became a real entity, and it was Dr. Zahuni's idea to try this new model instead of creating a new institute of obesity, under which it was great pressure to do that from the American Obesity Association and other lobbying groups. So I think this has been a terrific new experiment and a new departure, a new model for the way NIH institutes can work collaboratively together. It's been a terrific example, I think, and we've come a long way in 5 years.
Barry?
Thanks for really great talks. I learned quite a bit. There's an old adage that thought corrupts language, and the opposite is also true, that language corrupts thought. And one of the things that language can corrupt is also research questions. You know, you modify your research questions and study designs to fit the language that you're using. I think that we've made a transition from viewing obesity as a risk factor to viewing it as a disease. The public certainly has made that transition. We have helped them because we use terminology like epidemic of X, and usually you reserve the term epidemic for an actual disease. But we've started to use it for risk factors like obesity. The implications of that are twofold. One, in the behavioral messages that we get out there, that is, obesity is the disease, and if so, by any means necessary, becomes the modus operandi. If it takes surgery, if it takes behavior, if it takes exercise, if it takes medication, if it takes dietary supplements that contain ephedrine, it's all the same, because the endpoint has become obesity rather than the consequences of obesity. But also the downstream effect of that is the research questions. That is, you are allowed, therefore, to shorten the duration of study designs from 15 years or 10 years to a year or 18 months or 6 months, as a lot of the research is. And we don't, you know, the question is, how confident can we be that the risk factor is so tightly linked in every case, independent of what the intervention is, that we're going to achieve those health factors. It would be the equivalent of launching the Women's Health Initiative, identifying low HDL as the disease, and stopping the trial after a year because, with confidence, you have gotten where you need it. I just want to, is there that element? Will we devote the funding, therefore, to the study designs that may get around that impediment?
So that's an interesting question. I'm going to have Denise comment in just a minute. I think your point's very well taken. Certainly where we have our large observational cohorts, we can use those cohorts to make observations over a long period of time, like the social network in the Framingham Heart Study, or the heart failure and obesity from the Framingham Heart Study. The intervention studies, particularly in children and adolescents, my perception is that they're different, and perhaps Denise, you can speak to that, that perhaps the shortened study designs may be a function of simply the groups that you're studying, but I may be naive about this. Denise, you want to provide?
I'll make a comment, and then I would love to hear what Denise has to say, because I'm very interested. I'm not convinced that the EPI studies solve the problem, because it doesn't matter how many EPI studies you do, you'll see a link between cholesterol levels and heart disease. The question is, does that mean necessarily that any intervention that changes the cholesterol levels in the right direction will get us where we want? We found out from the Women's Health Initiative that if you go outside of drug class, that is, not only is it quantitatively wrong, it's qualitatively wrong.
So, Barry, you're asking a great question. I'm actually a clinical trialist because I believe the highest level of evidence about validity of if you change something and it has an effect on an outcome comes from clinical trials. So I think your question, if I could summarize it in my own words, is why is it appropriate for us to have obesity per se as an outcome in a clinical trial, in a randomized trial? Or even to have, you could extend it to hypertension level as an outcome, or cholesterol level, or other quote-unquote risk factors. And I actually think that we have the observational data linking with associations, but we also have randomized controlled trial data. Let me just take hypertension, for example, that you lower blood pressure, you're going to reduce cardiovascular disease events, and we have randomized controlled trial evidence that if you reduce obesity or body weight, you're going to reduce hypertension and blood pressure. And so it's a matter of judgment whether you think those two pieces of the causal chain are sufficient, or if you need to go from reducing obesity all the way to the heart events. I think we have the pieces of the chain from randomized trials in many cases, hypertension to CVD events, obesity, body weight to CVD. To hypertension. Dyslipidemia or blood cholesterol to CVD events, randomized trial evidence, and particularly for LDL cholesterol, and evidence that if we reduce obesity, we're going to reduce and improve LDL cholesterol levels. We have no randomized trial evidence that reducing obesity will reduce cardiovascular disease events. That's the purpose of the look-ahead trial. And that's why the look-ahead trial is being done, which is a DK-led, but NHLBI is collaborating also on it. I don't think you can always do event outcome trials, that there are pieces of the causal chain that you can scientifically study as separate if you have the other pieces already in place. I don't know if that answered your question. At least I thought that's what you were asking.
Well, that's what I was asking, but that is the chain of evidence argument is what kept the Women's Health Initiative from being launched for a long time, because it was felt that all the pieces were in place. That's all I'm saying.
Sue?
Yeah, until recently when I
give
talks about obesity, one of the things I had to say was that well, we've known about obesity for years, and now we know that it reduces risk factors like hypertension, and actually we now know that modest weight loss decreases the incidence of type 2 diabetes. Well, we haven't had evidence that it's actually going to impact mortality. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about. Now, with the SOS data having come out, which is not a randomized trial, but it's as close as we're probably going to get in bariatric surgery, they actually did find a substantial decrease in mortality with weight loss through bariatric surgery. But that was 15 years. Looking at it, it's a 12-year trial. So these are all very important, and I think the point you made is a good one. People can't necessarily assume that weight loss by any means is going to have the outcomes that you like. And you'll hear people get up at meetings where they're trying to get new drugs approved and tell you how many lives you're going to save by losing 10% of your body weight with this drug, and you really do need
evidence. Yeah, no, and I wanted to commend you. That was a terrific presentation, but I do want to address your issue, Barry, because I mean, the New England Journal clearly shows that there is a beneficial effect for decreasing obesity, but there's also an enormous amount of work from the preclinical literature showing that animals that are obese have significantly lower lifespans. So I think that there is not contention on that. But at the same time, I do think that there is a question that resonates very much that in and of itself is important. Is really obesity the disease, or is it just a risk factor? But if we call it as a disease, there's an advantage to it in that we can say, well, what are the risk factors for the obesity? And that leads me back to you, because I think that one of the aspects that we're viewing here is the complexity of the issues that we are driving the obesity. Is not just per se about food. You are assigning physical activity and the recognition, again, if you are obese and are physically active, apparently your outcomes are better. There's other aspects to it that I, again, highlight the importance of looking at it in this complex way, is sleep. I mean, 15 years ago, there was that elegant trial showing that just decreasing sleep by 25% significantly reduced leptin concentration in young men that were very, very healthy. And again, we're facing on a society at both levels where sleep disruption is actually one of the things of everyday life that then is affecting processes that regulate energy metabolism requirements. So highlighting the importance of bringing us all together. And then coming to your point, though, because you asked, I think this is exactly why we have a situation like OPASI. I mean, to me, it's just so very obvious, it's a non-brainer, because the processes that drive the motivation to eat and that can result, for example, in complete loss of control are the ones that drugs take over. So this is very, very salient. And it's very important for us to take advantage of that research in both sides of the field. But last week, I get a call from a senator's office concerned that us getting involved, for example, in this type of research detracts from the mission. And I have had the same question from ONDCP, the drug czar. So it basically puts some constraints in terms of the amount of resources that I like to be able to put. So if this is seen as a coordinated effort, then it becomes a much more transparent transition. And I think that may also be the case for other institutes that have different pressures from ours. So solidifying and crystallizing the importance of this as an NIH initiative will give me the freedom to be able to support research. And moreover, the other very important aspect, it hopefully will diminish redundancies. I believe in redundancy. But I think that redundancies can be an excess when we don't have enough resources.
Can you compare the neuroscience blueprint in this in any way? I know you don't know nearly as much about this as you do with blueprint.
Oh, I'm very interested on this, and I've actually, from the inception, and in fact, I brought Alan Spiegel to one of the main meetings in substance abuse to just speak on obesity. And every single meeting that we have, we coordinate a meeting on the neuroscience of food reward, because it's so extraordinarily important for all of the field. Mm-hmm. Now, the brain blueprint, this is one of the initiatives that I actually, when we were discussing the next big challenges, and one of the things that I've been putting forward at the Society for Neuroscience, I've been putting forward for the brain blueprint, the neuroscience of obesity and food reward, because like you see the hypothalamus. Well, the hypothalamus is part of the brain, and when you're changing the concentration of these receptors, negative or positive, the way that you're going to be driving the change is by the projections of that hypothalamic nuclei to a wide variety of sites in the brain. And the very interesting, for example, finding about these very unfortunate patients with bariatric surgery having a high incidence of suicide is likely actually to underline to some of these neurochemical changes that may, for example, relate to cannabinoid receptors.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's just coincidence that rimonabant, the cannabinoid 1 antagonist, is now being associated with a high rate of suicidal thinking.
Absolutely.
Again, highlighting how these are artificial fields. And so in the Brain Blueprint, this has been put up as of now. It hasn't been bought, but I think this is an incredible opportunity because I was saying you have imaging, but imaging is a tool. And what we really need to push forward is the whole neuroscience aspect of this food regard, and overeating, and then how that can lead to obesity.
Phil?
Yeah, I just want to add, since I'm sort of the neuroscience part of the obesity effort, we've been sort of a shadow neuroscience blueprint. It is a major focus and has been since its inception to look at the neurobiology of obesity within the task force. And we've had representatives from NIDA who have been very actively involved and who we've worked with and are now partnering with for the imaging initiative that's going forward. The same with mental health has been an active partner. So those have actually yielded some fruit. So, for example, the Mental Health Institute and the Diabetes Institute have recently put out an announcement to deal with the diabetogenic and obesogenic effects of second-generation antipsychotics, and which is a major concern among psychiatrists. And so we are, I think, at least I am within the task force, and I think everyone that I've talked to is really very agnostic about what we think is going on. That's why we have the initiative to look at separation of obesity from the comorbidities. We're not going in with any preconceived notions. There was an excellent paper by a group from UAB just last year that proposed 9 just as likely causes of obesity as opposed to simply an increase in eating high-fat foods, that where the data is at least as compelling. So I take that to heart. We know an awful lot, and it just shows us how little we know. And so as a group, we are absolutely committed to working with the Behavioral Office, for example, and with NIDA and with the other institutes.
But I think that, I mean, and that's absolutely correct, but at the Brain Blueprint itself, we don't have one single initiative from the Brain Blueprint that relates to obesity. That's where my point came around, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hate to cut off such a good discussion, but I will anyway. I really want to thank our two terrific speakers today, and all of you for coming and having such a good discussion. Thank you.
Before we leave, I do want to acknowledge Drs. Lisa Gancharoff and Stephanie Burrows, who are our executive secretaries and keep the Obesity Research Task Force on target. Thank you.